So, who are those unlabeled federal officers in Portland? Let's go to CBS national security correspondent Paul Violas, who is also the host of a new podcast, which is called Mending America. Paul, what do you know about these agents, as they're being called?
Dave, good morning. They are officers that have been authorized by the federal government to maintain order and to protect federal buildings, which they are entitled to. The markings disparity comes because they do not have names or badge numbers attached to their uniforms. Not that they don't have insignias saying that they're representing as a federal officer, but they just don't have their names in, out there, which is what's stirring the pot right now.
So are they, isn't there like a federal marshal service or something that's specifically tasked to protect federal buildings?
DHS is ultimately responsible. The marshal service also for with respect to courthouses. But the president, as and more so on the federal side, is obligated to make sure that federal buildings are protected, which is what's happening right now. The problem, though, Dave, the problem is that that doesn't entitle those federal officers to enforce local law and consequently to effect arrests in that regard. So therein lies where there appears to be that conflict with regards to the deployment of those officers.
So you're saying they should not have been arresting people?
They're not entitled to enforce local law. That's just what the law stipulates. They are entitled to enforce federal law if, in fact, they find people destroying the federal building. But for offenses not related to federal law, they're not supposed to be arresting people for under local law.
Okay. Well, this is have we seen this before, or is this a novel use of the Marshals Service?
Marshals are used constantly to protect federal buildings. What we haven't seen before, and this is, you know, 40 years of government service for me, what we have not seen before is the need for the federal government to deploy federal officers to protect against rioters. Now, we didn't even see this in the 60s, Dave. Mm-hmm. So, no, that clearly is unprecedented.
Okay, so what we're wondering here in Seattle is, could the same thing happen here? As far
100%.
As... 100%.
Okay. 100%, Dave. And in fact, Dave, I'd go so far as to say it's foreseeable.
Okay. Now, would that be true only if the demonstrators approach a federal building? Or, for example, the place was occupied up on Capitol Hill. There are no federal buildings in the area. I assume you wouldn't see any federal marshals up there. But
some of
the downtown facilities are near the U.S. courthouse. So what is their, their perimeter of responsibility? How close could you get to the courthouse before you run afoul of them?
That's a really good question, Dave. The cordon or the perimeter is going to be developed by the on-scene commander, and that's going to be developed by the intelligence that they have, that they've been able to garner relative to what they're projecting to be the threat against the building or personnel, and how far back they're going to need to create that perimeter in order to provide a relevant level of protection.
And what happens once you're bundled into the van? Do you go to a detention center of some kind? They take you to a local jail or what?
Right. Not a local jail. You're going to go to a federal detention center, and you'll be held there until you're questioned and released.
Like where they put the immigrants who are rounded up without their documents?
I don't believe that it would be the same location. I would believe that that would be a separate location. Border Patrol and ICE would have a certain location for that. In this particular case, it would most likely be the closest, with respect to proximity, the closest federal detention center.
I want to ask you, though, more generally about your mission in starting your podcast, Mending America. Where do you think we are here? I mean, I was under the impression, perhaps naively, that in cities like Seattle, which have been under federal scrutiny for years in terms of the use of force, we went through that process where we had a federal monitor for a while and the whole thing, that we had at least addressed the problem. But now it seems like we're back to square one.
You know what, Dave? The reason for the podcast was because I'm an old school guy, and I truly believe so much of what we see today can be resolved if we have fact-based conversations with the right people sitting at the table. Forget about the rhetoric. Forget about the partisanship. forget about the, you know, prosecutorial grandstanding, and let's roll our sleeves up and have a regular conversation. We're not. What we're starting to be able to do with the podcast are get the right people sitting at the table. I'll moderate. I mean, I've been through this before. I was the commander of the State Police Academy in Florida when we had the Rodney King incident, and, you know, was part of that national leadership that had to redirect our recruitment, our selection, our training, our use of force. And we got away from that because we got cheap, and now we're seeing the results. So I believe with the podcast, getting the right people at the table, we can affect some really positive change. And, you know, God willing, that's the mantra.
So are you a believer in police reform?
100%. We need police reform. I mean, that's not an option. We absolutely need police reform. But it needs to be balanced, Dave. We need community reform as well. This isn't a thing of let's hang out police. This is a relationship. Relationship has two sides to it. And we need to all sit at the table and stop with the nonsense and the finger pointing. And let's really get down to the truth about why we're having issues with the police, why we're having issues in the community, who's going to own those changes, and let's make the changes happen.
CBS law enforcement and security analyst Paul Violas, he is the moderator of the podcast Mending America. Paul, thanks very much. I appreciate it.
Yes, sir. Entirely my pleasure. Have a great day, Dave.
And as coronavirus cases rise, school districts are starting to release plans for getting school back open again. And more than half a dozen Washington counties are hoping to move to the next phase, yet have been denied. And a new poll finds that most Washingtonians support a pause on reopening the economy. Let's get the report from Cairo Radio's Hannah Scott.
Nearly 800 new coronavirus cases were reported by the State Health Department yesterday, pushing the total number of cases since the start of the pandemic to 47,743. Another half dozen deaths were also reported, bringing that tally to 1,453. King County continues to see daily case counts near or above 200. The message from health officials remains the same. Do your part, wear your mask, socially distance, and wash your hands, or we'll be in big trouble. The latest statewide situation report shows COVID-19 is on a runaway path in the state, with hospitalization rates rising throughout Washington. In eastern Washington, hospitalizations continue to increase across all age groups. In western Washington, the rates are just starting to increase, led by hospitalizations among 20 to 39-year-olds. As case counts once again grow among older and more vulnerable people, hospitalizations are expected to continue to trend up. Officials call it an explosive situation statewide. In Spokane County, they're seeing exponential growth already, and other counties may follow suit if the rise in the spread of cases can't be slowed down. Not helping the situation, testing delays.
Now, in Washington and in many other states across the country, with the rapid surge of disease activity, particularly in other states with an even more rapid increase of disease activity and the corresponding ramp up in testing levels, we're starting to see emerging significant challenges for acquiring adequate lab supplies.
Reid Schuler, senior policy advisor for the governor.
We've seen a major slowdown nationally for the large out-of-state commercial labs that supply approximately 20% of the positive test results for the state, down to on the order of a six-day turnaround with some very real implications for our ongoing public health efforts to then limit ongoing transmission from positive results.
And he says that's going to make things worse here.
These supply challenges will be manifesting in a variety of our labs in the state. And while so far we've been able to continue to increase our testing throughput, these challenges are likely already limiting our ability to continue those increases at the levels that we would like. And if left unaddressed, these shortages could force us to restrict and even ration testing down the line at precisely the moment when we need to expand our testing operations.
Meantime, school districts are starting to release their plans for what back to school will look like come fall. Some districts east of the Cascades are set on finding ways to get all kids back to 100% in-person classes, while other districts across the state are focusing in on hybrid models, part in-person, part remote. Here on the western side, there's less support for 100% in-person classes. The Kent School District now announcing it will start the year off with all remote learning for at least the first quarter of the school year. That runs through about the end of October. Meantime, all counties in the state are remaining in whatever phase they had been in for at least another week as the governor pushes pause on advancing to the next phase. More than a half dozen applications to move to the next phase from counties have just been rejected by the state health department. Meantime, a new Crosscut Elway poll shows 26% of people across the state feel like restrictions should be reimposed to control the spread of the virus, while 33% said reopening should be on pause to see what happens. Another 38% thinks that we should just keep opening as planned. Overall, the poll found 72% of Democrats and 23% of Republicans are worried about the state's reopening.
And Hannah joins us live. So has tracing been a bust then because of the delays in testing?
It's an issue, yes. It's definitely an issue. I don't think it's an out-of-control issue yet, but the backlog and the delays for testing at the national labs is already causing that delay. It has been for a couple of weeks. I know that there were tests that were taking 7 days to come back on average from those nationalists. So the state health department is asking everyone to go to our state labs. So go have that rapid test inside at the provider instead of the ones where you do the nasal swabs and they have to be sent out because those are turned around faster here again at our state labs. But even that is going to be a supply issue is what the governor's policy advisor is saying there. So there's going to be like the trickle down effect. So I think we're probably getting into that right now.
What is it that's not working then? Do we get any more information about whether it's people just partying like crazy or are they deliberately breathing on each other? I mean, why is it not working?
It's absolutely. Everywhere in the state that you go, every local health department is saying the same thing. This is because people are gathering and not taking the precautions that they're encouraged to take. And again, I think the numbers we're seeing now over the last several days have been the result of a lot of gatherings starting at the 4th of July. And the weather's been nicer. People are going out. You have your mask mandates indoors and things like that. But a lot of people are getting together at homes, family gatherings, whatever that might be, barbecues, backyard picnics are the things that are being described to be the problem, even when you're outside.
Well, this would make sense. This could be a 4th of July blip, but if that's it, then now that the message is out, 2 weeks from now, we should see a drop, shouldn't we?
We should, if everyone is listening, if everyone is doing what all of the health officials and the governor is asking, then presumably you would see those numbers go down. But whether everyone is doing that, I don't know. I haven't seen any of the latest mobility reports as far as how many people are out and doing their thing. And I don't know how many people are wearing masks. I still see people around my community, despite the mandates, who aren't wearing masks and going into certain businesses without masks. Hmm. So I don't know that everybody is getting the message. And, if a few don't do it, does it matter? I don't know.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I would think that most businesses now are requiring masks, so it doesn't strike me as that's going to be the main reason for transmission. I guess it would just have to be congregating at beaches and enjoying all the nice weather. There's no indication that the virus has suddenly been able to, leap the 6-foot distance, whereas it might not have before. It's just that people are still getting too close, huh?
Not that I have seen thus far. We're just at the point in the week where I expect to start getting all of my health department updates for the week. So it'll be interesting to see what's changed from last week to this week. Definitely. Again, that statewide situation report that came out on Friday where they called this just an explosive situation. I mean, that's as much of an alarm bell as I've seen throughout.
Are our hospitals in the same situation as we're seeing down in Texas, for example?
No. Yeah, not yet. But they are rising, and they are rising, especially in Spokane County. They're seeing significant rise in Spokane County in hospitalizations. And Western Washington is not seeing hospitalizations rise as much as the eastern part of the state, but they are seeing them rise. And that is a concern, because once that starts, that tends to get worse. And we're seeing the other thing they're concerned about is that a lot of the people getting infected are the younger people. Yeah. Even heard some people in the younger crowd up to age 29, I think it was, that are being hospitalized. But then this starts to shift as the younger people get it to the more vulnerable people, to the older populations. And once that starts, we've even got an outbreak at a nursing home facility in the state right now. And once that kind of thing starts happening, happening, that's when you see that really rapid exponential growth like we saw in the beginning. And right now, both on the eastern part of the state and the western part of the state, that R-naught number is believed to be that transmission rate, how many other people you infect per each case, is above one. I believe it's 1.5-ish for both parts of the state. And that's the concern, because that number continues to go up.
Right. Well, we've learned the sunshine doesn't kill it, right?
Yep.
Yep. Hannah Scott, thank you, Hannah.
You bet.
It's time for your daily dose of kindness now, sponsored by Mike Novak and listwithnovak.com. Turning lemons of this awful pandemic into lemonade. Just had a conversation with my seven-year-old, well, the other day, and throughout these sunny weather days. She's big into making cash where she can, selling her creations to neighbors and family members. She wants to donate the money to food banks. She'll send some dollars to animals at Posado Safe Haven. Sometimes she'll buy a Lego kit or chapstick, you know, things seven-year-olds are into. But I keep telling her she's limited in how she can sell. You can't open a stand this year, I'll say, because of the pandemic, she'll moan. She'll reminisce about the lemonade stand she ran last summer. She made a killing. People are so generous when they want a cup of lemonade. She'll sell it for 25 cents and they'll give her $5. It's amazing. So I know she's not alone in wanting to run a lemonade stand or whatever it is. Kids across America do this. It's a rite of passage, really. So the company, Country Time, which makes the lemonade powder, decided to back these little entrepreneurs this summer. They've started their own stimulus program.
It's lemonade stand season. But this year, things are looking dry. And those small business bailouts are going to not-so-small corporations. Steakhouses, sports teams, oil companies. Big guys muscling little guys out of the way. That doesn't seem right. But now, the smallest of small businesses are about to get some help. Country Time introduces the littlest bailout.
What kids can do is, if you're 14 and under, you can write an essay about how they would have spent their lemonade stand money and submit a photo of the lemonade stand sign they would have used, and they can receive a $100 check in the mail.
Whoa!
From Country Time. Isn't that nice?
Yes.
It's very nice. So, you know, I think it not only teaches kids that they can persevere, but they have to write a sort of business plan. You can turn this into a summer assignment, if you will. They need a business plan. They've got to create a sign, take a picture, send it in. They want $100.
You can still run a lemonade stand, though, can't you? Outdoors? Keep people distant? I mean, I'd go grocery shopping indoors.
I mean, you could, distance. But why would you want to risk it, right?
There was one, actually, it's been a month ago, there was a lemonade stand in our neighborhood, and she was even smarter. She was giving it away for free.
Oh.
Of course, I paid $5.
Oh, see, that's what I'm saying. People are so, you could stand outside there with a little smile, and people will just throw money at you. So, anyway, if you want your kid to submit a business plan, they can get a $100 check from Country Time. I thought that was really nice.
It is 7:40, and coming up on Seattle's Morning News,
we'll check in on Portland, and also G. Scott is going to join us. And let's see, what are we going to talk about with G. Scott? I don't know yet. Should
be good,
though.
I have a list of five things.
Okay.
Plenty, don't worry. And now from the G. and Ursula Show, weekdays 9 to noon here on Cairo Radio, here's G. Scott. So, we're getting close to the NFL season, but the rumor mill is saying that the NFL has now offered to cancel the entire preseason.
Mm-hmm. Good. This would be good. This would give look, we all want the NFL to be successful with this, and I'll get to that in a second on why we really want the NFL to be successful, to help all of us. Anyways, this would be good for them so that they can, have enough time to get comfortable with their protocols and just kind of give some time so that these players can be safe in the best way possible. And then when we get ready to get game time, you got to think. So here's an example. Let's just say that they have to ramp up and they prepare for, let's just say, one to two preseason games. Mm-hmm. And then they play the preseason game. And then on the second game, they show up and they do the thing and they're done. And then afterwards, Russell Wilson tests positive for COVID.
Yeah.
So if Russell Wilson tests positive for COVID, well, we all know the rules, right? He's going to have to quarantine for 14 days. So that means he's probably going to miss one, maybe two NFL football games. So we don't want to, We don't want that to happen. So I like this idea, Dave. I want them to just go ahead and start the regular season just the same way that they do in college with no preseason or anything getting going.
So you think there's going to be a season?
Yes. Do I think the season is going to start at the beginning of September like it usually does? In my opinion, no.
Why is that?
I think they want to get some time. And I think it would be great for them if they probably waited. So I think the season starting maybe mid-September, just going another 2 weeks. I mean, as we know, if we could do the right things, we're all trying to flatten this coronavirus and try to get cases to start flattening and going down. And I think that we all as a country get responsible, start doing some of the right things, we can start seeing those numbers go down. So I think that those guys will probably go mid-September or something like that, end of September. I just think it just gives us more time to get a hold of this.
What did you think of Michael Bennett retiring and the statement he made where he felt like he was being treated like, produce?
Is that what he said?
No, he didn't say that.
Oh, yeah. Well,
it was a little more graphic than that.
Well, I have to read it. I had a lot to say about it, but then I heard what Colleen said about Michael Bennett and everything. So,
well, you want to talk about that? I just nearly fell to the floor when I found out he's younger than me. I don't know why that always trips me up when I learn the ages of these NFL players. Maybe because
you guys don't know nothing.
I know. But I mean, he's such a giant, and he's such a powerful force as well. It really makes you assess what you've accomplished in your life and what more you can do. He's a really great guy. I really enjoy his commentary and, of course, how he plays, too.
So I'm glad you brought that up, Colleen, because let this be a reminder, too. I mean, there might be some kids that are listening right now, and this is why an education is so important. This is why being a good person is so important, because Michael Bennett has, and I'm not saying that Michael Bennett isn't educated or not a nice person. What I'm saying is Michael Bennett has had a great NFL career. He's won a Super Bowl. And here Colleen is talking about, like, wow, I had no idea he was this young. Well, just think, he's done with football. Mm-hmm. He now has the rest of his life to live. Right. So in order to live that, it's not going to be football that's going to carry him the rest of the way. It's going to be hopefully he's got an education. Hopefully he's got some experience, because he's still going to need to make money and to provide. And contrary to what everybody believes, these NFL players don't. How can I say this? They don't. They make money, but they don't. All that money doesn't actually get saved. Right?
Right.
That doesn't always happen for them. So when they get out in their late 20s, early 30s. And by the way, if you get out in your late 20s, early 30s, that means you had a really good career. Mm-hmm. Because the average NFL life is only 2.7 years. 2.7 years is the average amount of time that an NFL player makes it in the NFL. So if you leave the college at 22, that means you leaving out the NFL at 24, 25 years old. So to make it to 28 to 30 is great. Now, I think like to think that we like to live at least another 50 years on top of that 30. So that's to 80 years old. So that means for the next 50 years, Michael Bennett is going to have to make money for him and his family. And it's just tough to do. And that's why I always take this time to really stress the importance of education, being a good person. I never talk about the NFL with my kids.
Yeah.
Never.
He's only 34, and he wrote, "Retiring feels like a death of self, but I'm looking forward to the rebirth." And I just want to say, as his elder,
mm-hmm.
he has plenty of time for that.
I'll say this. They go through a very hard time.
No doubt. It's his life.
When they get rid, it's, according to what they tell me, it's worse than any breakup than they've ever had.
I believe it. I can't imagine breaking up with an identity I've had since junior high, which is radio and broadcast.
Yeah, but don't you get it? I mean he's going to get like lots that. Of offers. I mean, he's created a brand for himself, right? I mean, a very positive brand. And I know he's got a lot of social justice matters on his mind, which will certainly, I mean, talk about a great time for that that kind of activism.
Well,
I mean, come on.
Great point, Dave, but let's be real. When you start getting deeper, deep into activism, activism and giving of your time, then you start to realize that, wait, the money don't match what I used to make, right? Like, well, yeah. True activism, you're just not rolling out, you know, $250,000 a year to be doing that. You're actually
getting he must have saved something. I mean, you get some advice, don't you, when you join the NFL about what to do with your money. I understand the demands of family and you want to do right by your relations and everything, but you do save at least, what, half of it maybe?
I got advice on marriage and got divorced twice, so there you go.
Yeah. Tuesday mornings, we go live to the nation's capital and Pulitzer Prize winning reporter David Farenthold at the Washington Post. David, good morning.
Good morning.
You might be the only reporter we know who'll send a tweet of a hotel bill and it sets off a flurry of math calculations. At least that's what we did. So give me the, what did you discover about the bills for the Secret Service at Mar-a-Lago?
Well, one of the weirdest things about Mar-a-Lago, which obviously gets a lot of money from both the U.S. government and from Republican committees, Trump's own campaign, is that Mar-a-Lago apparently doesn't have a credit card machine that can process transactions larger than $10,000. So anybody who buys something big at Mar-a-Lago, and the government and the Republicans often do, has to break it up into a million little pieces. So what caught our eye was in a spending report about Trump's own campaign, which spent $380,000 in Mar-a-Lago, but did it in 43 separate payments, all of them under $10,000. And when we saw that, we thought, well, this is the strangest thing I've ever seen. It's 43 payments. Like, who would go to that trouble? But I guess the answer is that Mar-a-Lago, although it takes so much money, doesn't make it easy on the people who are paying it.
Yeah. So you found out, and the reason you're doing this is because the president, I believe, had said that when the Secret Service stays at one of his hotels, because he has a protection detail, that they give the government a special discount rate.
Eric Trump, the president's son, had said that when any government official comes with his father to Trump properties, the Trump board would like to charge them nothing, but they have to charge them a little bit, so they charge them $50 a night. And so I've now looked at hundreds and hundreds of hotel bills where the U.S. government was being charged by the Trump Organization, mm-hmm. and I have found literally not one example that was like that. Everything else was much higher. All the rates were actually much higher.
So what are they charging a night?
Well, it goes anywhere from $242 a night at the Trump Hotel in D.C. up to $650 a night at Mar-a-Lago for hotel rooms, and they rent out a cottage to the U.S. government in Bedminster for $17,000 a month.
Yikes. Well, when I saw that tweet, I saw a number of people challenging your math on it, and you responded to them. So we now know that your math is accurate. Not that I ever doubted you for a moment.
Well, you should. It's always a dodgy proposition.
Well, in any case, $600 a night, and I've paid that much. I mean, I remember one night we were stuck in a snowstorm with my parents. We were having to stay at a downtown hotel. It was like the Hilton right there in Columbus Circle. I paid $700 a night. So, mm-hmm. I mean, that's crazy. But after being promised $50 a night, that seems like a discrepancy. So have you figured out what's going on here?
Well, I mean, the basic gist of this is that President Trump, when he came into office, said that he would separate himself from his business. His presidency and his business would be separate. And instead, as everybody knows, he's broken that promise by traveling to his own properties hundreds of times and bringing along himself, but also his retinue of security officers and aides. And that means that lots and lots of government money, at least $970,000 that I found so far, goes to his business. So then a secondary promise was made. Okay, yes, we're going to mix the business and the presidency, but we're not going to profit off it. You know, we're only going to charge $50 a night. That promise was made by the Trump Organization when we didn't have these receipts, when we had no way to check that they were telling us the truth. Now that we have the receipts, we know they weren't telling us the truth. So, you know, that makes me think there's more here. If they've violated their promises twice, what else is out there?
Yeah. Well, we won't know because despite the recent court decisions, that's the finance is going to remain secret for a while. Did you read Mary Trump's book?
I have read parts of it. My actual copy has not arrived yet, but I've read as many excerpts as I can get.
You can download it in a second on your Kindle, David. I don't know why.
I don't believe in those sort of things.
You don't. You're owned by Jeff Bezos. You don't believe in that.
Actually, my Kindle's broken. I haven't ordered a new
Kindle
one,
so
I have to go for the hardcover.
They practically give them away. All right, so she was apparently the source of the New York Times original story on his finances and the amount of money that he got from his dad. And I guess one thing, why I bring it up is after reading the book, I can understand why the Trump Organization, if they felt they could get away with it, would charge as much as they could for the room. Cause that was dad's practice. I mean, the idea was to make money in any mostly legal way possible.
That's right. I mean, the whole history of the Trump Organization, it appears from what the Times found in Mary Trump's archives, was a long, long effort to evade income taxes. So much of how the business ran internally, so much of its accounting was dedicated to transferring Fred Trump's wealth to his children in ways that the IRS wouldn't see and that would avoid inheritance taxes. So they put a lot of effort into evading the law, it appears. So you're right. It's a lot of the same accountants and people that helped run Fred Trump's company now run Donald Trump's company. So if that's the way they ran their business for decades, maybe it's not surprising that they would not hold to their promises here.
This afternoon, we will have the return of the coronavirus briefings. The president has decided to bring them back. Is this an indication? Did he miscalculate here? Because it seems like he was trying to convince the country that this is over. Let's move on. But that did not work.
That's right. You actually saw quotes. We had a good story the other day where they quoted Trump's chief of staff, Mark Meadows, saying the best approach is to ignore this, to pretend like it's not happening. And I think Trump has found that untenable now. So now he's going to go back to, I don't know why there's no middle ground between ignoring it and then having these press conferences that are just sort of rambling monologues where he talks up various drugs and things like that. You know, there is a middle ground. And to be honest, it's very politically profitable for people who have chosen it, which is to talk about the virus, but to talk and wait to let the scientists talk. That redounds to the benefit of the politicians. Trump seems unwilling to choose that. So we're now going back to him.
Yeah. Well, I mean, is he in fact going to host them again, or is he going to defer to the scientists?
Well, I mean, we'll see today. But my impression from seeing what he said about it is that it's not Anthony Fauci's briefing. It's Donald Trump's briefing. So I think it'll be Trump again. And I imagine we'll hear about a lot of stuff that's not the coronavirus, like what's happening in Portland.
Yeah. You saw him tweeting his masked face the other day, right?
Yeah, that to me was a great example of like how low the bar is for Trump, that he wears a mask months after everyone said you should wear a mask. And then immediately, you know, there's this sense of like accomplishment. Isn't it great that he wore a mask?
Well, I was happy to see that. I mean, it's something. It may help with some people. No,
sure. I'm happy he's doing it. But, you know, you don't get much credit to me for doing it 3 months after everybody said you should be doing it.
On the relief bill, I think that's actually what probably affects the most people in this country. The $600 a month payments are going to run out. The Republicans are worried that the payments themselves are keeping people from returning to work. So what do you think is likely to come out of this?
I've been puzzled by this just because it seems obvious political suicide to cut this money off for the Republicans. Nobody out there, you know, these payments are really helping people through a pandemic that is only getting worse. And you know, so the option of going back to work for many people is not that, it's just not there because the country's shutting down again. So I have always believed the Republicans would come around and recognize that they would only hurt themselves politically if they cut this money off. But maybe they're so far into the echo chamber that they really believe that it's better for the country to let people, you know, basically go on their own.
Oh, by the way, I almost forgot. What did you think about Chris Wallace's interview with Trump over the weekend?
Wallace is a great interviewer, and I thought he did a really good job. He always seems to sneak up on Trump because Trump, I guess, because he's coming from Fox and Trump doesn't expect it. I've always thought Wallace is one of the best interviewers of this sort of Sunday morning, you know, chat show people, and he did a great job with Trump. I thought he handled Trump's responses really, really well.
Yeah,
playing part by not getting mad.
But talk about having a pair to fact check him during the interview, and then especially on the Democratic platform where the president was claiming Biden's in favor of defunding the police, and Wallace, who apparently had read all, 100 pages of it or whatever, yeah, it was.
The only person who ever had.
Yeah, that's right. Said, no. And Trump says, give me the papers. And he himself can't find it. And doing it on the patio outside the Oval Office, I got to hand it to him.
Yeah, it was pretty. Wallace has always been good like that. And I think for some reason, Trump lets Wallace surprise him every time.
Yeah. David Farenthold, live from The Washington Post. David, thank you.
Thank you. You can ring my
bell. Ring the bell. This is Seattle's Morning News. Dave Ross with Colleen O'Brien and Chris Sullivan. Rachel Bell joins us now. There has been a grant established in memory of Seattle film director Lynn Shelton. Tell us about this.
Right. So Lynn Shelton unfortunately passed away on May 16th of this year, just a couple months ago. She was a beloved Seattle filmmaker, and she had an undiagnosed blood disease. She thought that she had the flu, and a couple days later, she passed away. She was only 54 years old. If you're not familiar with Lynn's work, she wrote and directed a ton of her own films, including My Sister's Sister. Her last film was called Sword of Trust, which starred Marc Maron, who after the filming became her partner. And when I had Lynn on my podcast, Your Last Meal, she talked about getting into filmmaking later in her life. She was 39 years old when her first feature came out. And even though she had always wanted to be a filmmaker, she thought at 39 years old, she was too old to start something new.
And I was making my living as an editor and teaching other people how to edit. Saw Claire Denis, who's a French director who came to town, Northwest Film Forum brought her and did a retrospective of her work. And in this onstage interview she did, she revealed that she hadn't even started her career as a filmmaker until she was 40. And she'd already made a bunch of movies, and now she's made a bunch more. And I was like, oh my God, I'm a lady too, and I'm not quite 40. And it means I can still have a career. And she truly was a huge inspiration for me to just dive in and get going. And honestly, we bring so much more to the table because we've actually lived life a little bit, you know? So I feel like I could bring more perception and sensitivity and experience, you know, to my stories.
So Seattle's Northwest Film Forum, which is an art film house, they also teach classes in filmmaking. They bring in filmmakers to do talks. They have collaborated with the Duplass Brothers production to offer a new grant, and it's called the Lynn Shelton of a Certain Age Grant. I spoke with Megan Griffith. She's also a Seattle filmmaker. She was one of Lynn's very best friends, and she's a board member at the Film Forum.
It's designed for women and non-binary filmmakers who are 39 years or older and haven't made their first feature, and that essentially describes Lynn in 2005 when she made her first feature, We Go Way Back. She was 39 years old. We wanted to build the grant around sort of Lynn's legacy of having this quote unquote late start in life and being of a certain age before she started making films. And it only made her films better and more formed by life experience.
Here is Northwest Film Forum Executive Director Vivian Hua.
The grant to start is going to be $25,000 a year. And we have a series of really generous donors who have stepped up to offer that on a multi-year basis. And we're not really asking for specific projects or anything like that. People don't need to pitch a project to be nominated. It's more based off of what has been seen as their strong work samples or like reputation. It's about investing in a person that someone sees potential in rather than them having to prove that they have it all figured out already.
So this is open to anyone in the country, but Megan says that she's surprised how big the response has been and how many people at that age are interested in this grant.
The film industry is kind of notorious for being very excited about what's new and fresh and young and male typically. and so it's really was inspiring to see Lynn break out, you know, basically in her 40s and go on from that point to create this giant body of work through her features and her TV work that many people decades younger than her weren't able to amass that amount of credit. So it's once you find your thing that you're meant to do, it just sometimes just clicks.
And this reminds me of one of my heroes, Julia Child, because she was the same way. I mean, I can't remember at this point if it was when her cooking show came out or her first cookbook, but she was 50. She didn't start cooking at all until she was 40. And so it's kind of a reminder for people like me who are 40 right now that You can do so much more later in your life. You know, I think you get nervous sometimes, like you went to school for a certain thing. And so you have to keep doing that for the rest of your life.
Yeah, there is a future for late bloomers. And the thing about Julia Child, though, was that she had a natural presence that is probably, that's the thing you're born with. The cooking you can learn, right? But being able to present it in a way that appeals to millions of people is the thing that's tough to teach.
Yeah. And also it's hard to get in. I mean, there's plenty of people who are so talented in all arenas. I mean, there's so many bands out there that are so great, but they'll never make it. And so I think part of this grant is kind of helping people find their way and get in. I think the film industry is particularly daunting, you know, costs a lot of money. And then, you know, where do you screen your films? Who do you know? Do you have an agent? And this is kind of just a way to help someone who might not have big connections find their way into to do their passion.
So is there a point in applying for this new grant? Because it sounds like the hopper is full already.
I mean, it's new. It just started, so you can still apply. It sounds like you have to be nominated. I don't fully understand the process.
Sort of like the Genius Award.
You have to be
nominated by a mysterious unnamed person.
Exactly. The ghost of Patrick Swayze is the one usually doing the nominations. Yeah, I think they're trying to actually cut down the list by this nomination process. Kind of makes it so every single person can apply because they don't have a big staff to go through the stack.
Right.
But you can definitely still get in on this. Go to MyNorthwest.com/Rachel Bell. It's B-E-L-L-E. You'll find a link so that you can understand the nomination process and maybe, you know, find a secret person to nominate you.
That's right. Rachel Bell. Thank you, Rachel.
Thanks, Dave.
I'm Dave Ross.
And I'm Colleen O'Brien. Thanks for listening to Seattle's Morning News.
You can hear us live every morning on 97.3 FM or subscribe to this podcast and you'll never miss the show.